Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Cindy Cohn, legal director with the Electronic Frontier Foundation, who explains why she believes President Obama's proposed reforms to the NSA's Dragnet surveillance program fall short. Reverend Dr. Jim Antell, minister and president of the Massachusetts Conference of the United Church of Christ, who talks about why his church voted to divest their $750 million endowment fund from fossil fuel companies. And Marge Baker of People for the American Way, who assesses recently proposed congressional legislation to strengthen the 1965 Voting Rights Act, substantially weakened in a June 2013 Supreme Court decision. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
A new report by the U.S.-based Nuclear Threat Initiative documents progress in recent years to secure nuclear materials from theft, but criticizes the U.S. Congress for failing to ratify two new treaties to safeguard them. The NTI report is also critical of the Obama administration for not allowing international arms inspectors access to the H Canyon, a Cold War-era weapons facility at the Savannah River Nuclear Complex in South Carolina. The facility now separates fissile material from foreign and domestic research center waste. Another site at the Savannah River Complex, known as K Acres, has been under inspection by the International Atomic Energy Administration for a decade. Scott Sagan, a member of the Nuclear Threat Initiative's panel of experts, told the Center for Public Integrity, "The U.S. faces a trade-off when its facilities are involved in sensitive technologies. For the sake of nonproliferation and nuclear security, we want to show transparency and be open to safeguards." Russian security forces, who have mobilized what they call a ring of steel to protect the upcoming Sochi Winter Olympic Games, went into a frenzy after recent reports that a suspected female suicide bomber, known as the Black Widow, was sighted in downtown Sochi. The hijab-clad woman, known as Ruzana Ibragimov, is the widow of an Islamic militant killed by Russian police in 2013. She pledged to exact revenge by becoming a shahid, or martyr. Over the summer, a Muslim militant in the Northern Caucasus threatened to stop the Sochi Games. The threats of terrorist attacks in Russia have caused many families and supporters of U.S. Olympic athletes to rethink their travel plans to Sochi, a resort city bordering the Black Sea and the Northern Caucasus region. The threats became very real late last year when two suicide bombings were carried out shortly before New Year's Eve, targeting Volgograd's train station and a trolley bus that killed 34 people and injured more than 100. In the weeks after the bombings, Russian security forces have detained wives and widows of known Islamic militants. According to the Christian Science Monitor, 60 women from Astrakhan, a region northeast of the troubled Caucasus zone, are under investigation for ties to militants. On election night, Jay Cantor, founder of the Working Families Party, stood in the back of the Brooklyn Armory, basking in the glow of a significant progressive victory when Bill de Blasio was elected mayor of New York City in a landslide, along with wins by allies Letitia James as public advocate and Scott Stringer as comptroller. For Cantor, the progressive sweep in the Big Apple is the result of 15 years of grassroots work, building coalitions with community activists and progressive unions. The Working Families Party began by employing a strategy of cross-endorsing mainstream Democrats. But over the years, the party evolved and grew by recruiting and training progressive activists to run in local races and win tough campaigns. Now the Working Families Party is going national, expanding from its base in New York, Connecticut, and Oregon. The party is exporting its union-supported organizing model and has already begun operations in the District of Columbia. Over the next few months, the WFP will move into Pennsylvania and Maryland and plans to organize in Wisconsin later in 2014. On the eve of the de Blasio election in New York, Cantor told the American Prospect, "We have a cornucopia of good ideas, debt-free college, paid sick days, but nobody cares about your good ideas if you don't have the power." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
7 months after Edward Snowden, the former NSA contractor turned whistleblower, revealed details of the U.S. National Security Agency's secret, massive surveillance of Americans' communications, President Obama attempted to address rising public concern about these issues. Having received a set of 46 recommendations from a panel of 5 intelligence and legal experts he had earlier appointed to assess the need for reform, the president laid out his proposals to restructure NSA surveillance programs. He announced his decision to end the Section 215 bulk metadata program as it currently exists and establish a new, still unknown method to store communications data, taking the government out of that role. Mr. Obama stated that NSA agents would now need to get authorization from a special intelligence court before accessing data on specific targets, and further said he had ordered a halt to surveillance targeting dozens of allied foreign leaders' phone calls. Another reform adopted by the president would install a public advocate on the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court in certain cases to challenge surveillance operations that endanger civil liberties. A week after Mr. Obama's speech, the Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board issued an opinion that the NSA's dragnet surveillance of phone data is illegal and maintained that the program has been largely useless in fighting terrorism. While many civil liberties advocates welcomed the president's effort to address privacy concerns, many were disappointed, asserting that his proposed reforms failed to address key issues. Your reporter spoke with Cindy Cohn, legal director and general counsel with the Electronic Frontier Foundation, who assesses President Obama's NSA reform plan and the work that still must be done to secure privacy rights and rein in the potential for abuse.
We put together a scorecard where we had 12 things that we wanted to watch to see if Obama embraced. And we gave him a score of 3.5 out of 12. Frankly, we were being generous on a couple of them. So that's not really very good, you know, when you think about the scope of the reform that we need. And sadly, you know, even as to some of those, the president really didn't show a lot of leadership. He didn't say, look, you know, we need to stop this collection. I mean, he did say that we needed to stop the phone records program in its current form, but then he gave 60 days for them to try to figure out another way to get the same information in just a, you know, slightly different process for it. So while that was nice that he acknowledged that there was a problem, his solution isn't really a solution at all yet. He did recognize that there needs to be an independent voice on the FISA court. That's the secret court that approves some of these surveillance programs, and it's a one-sided court. Only the government's allowed to go there. And he did actually embrace the idea of some independent voice in that court, and we gave him a point for that. And he also did, you know, kind of indicate that maybe foreigners had some privacy rights, which was also nice, although we'll see what comes up with that. He kind of kicked that idea down the road as well.
Overall, how do you rate the president and his administration's response to the revelations from Edward Snowden? After all, they targeted him as a traitor, not as a whistleblower, and have a warrant out for his arrest. They've taken away his passport. He, of course, is viewed by many as a hero and a whistleblower and sparked an important debate in our country. But what do you think the Obama administration, you know, how have they treated this whole flood of new information that the public now has?
Well, I mean, I think that they've been really abysmal, especially given that President Obama did, you know, he campaigned on the idea that he was going to bring rule of law back to our surveillance. And you know, that was a part of his original campaign promises. I mean, he's really fallen a long way from those days in terms of things, both in terms of his, you know, apparent unwillingness to change any of the mass surveillance technologies in any significant way. I mean, remember, one of the big things that's happened here is, you know, instead of, what I think the Fourth Amendment requires, which is the government makes an individual showing before they have access to your personal information, be that content or non-content, that's gotten flipped on its head, where the government is collecting everything first and then sorting out second whether there's anything that might be relevant to an investigation. And I think that's improper, and it's very sad that, you know, a man who campaigned on trying to bring rule of law back to surveillance has really signed off on something that is such a dramatic shift from, you know, what I think the Constitution requires, and certainly something that was worthy of a public discussion, not being done in secret. And of course, he signed off on the secrecy as well. Then you raised the other point, which is, I think, you know, in addition to signing off on the secrecy, the Obama administration has issued an indictment against the man who, you know, arguably, you know, brought this debate to a whole other level. Even President Obama admitted that, you know, this was a debate that was worthy of having, and we wouldn't be having it. And I, you know, I speak from personal experience. I've been trying to get the country to talk about this since 2006, and you know, you're one of the folks who's been listening for a while, but there certainly wasn't the level of public conversation between 2006 and last June as there's been since. And the only explanation for that is Mr. Snowden. So I think to treat him as if, you know, what he did doesn't have any public interest at all is really not right. And I don't think it's what America stands for.
Your belief that President Obama's proposed reforms fall short of what's needed. There is legislation in Congress called the USA Freedom Act that really overturns some key elements of the USA Patriot Act that was passed by Congress shortly after 9/11. Do you think the USA Freedom Act does enough to reverse this Dragnet surveillance program or the various programs that the NSA runs?
I think it's a really good start, and there's a lot of good things in the USA Freedom Act. There's some, you know, I would prefer to see the act basically stop mass surveillance. It tries to do it through a little addition of some words that says pertain to a specific investigation. They're trying to do a tiny little fix and hope that stops mass surveillance. I think that I would certainly prefer that they just say, you know, notwithstanding any other law, you just can't do mass surveillance. So I'd like to see some fixes to the USA Freedom Act, but it's really a very, very good start. It does a good job of articulating how to make the FISA court more fair and how to have independent people there. I wish that Obama had embraced that specific way of doing it in his announcement that he was going to bring some balance to the FISA court. And there's a lot of other good things in there. We got a little more work to do to make it all the way there. There's also a bill that Rush Holt has introduced that does, I think, things a little better. But, you know, the Leahy-Sensenbrenner bill is really got a lot of juice behind it, and that's a good thing. So, you know, we need to do a little more work, but we're almost there with it.
That was Cindy Cohn, Legal Director and General Counsel with the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Find a link to her article, Rating Obama's NSA Reform Plan, by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In the summer of 2012, environmentalist Bill McKibben published his seminal article, Global Warming's Terrifying New Math, which kicked off a national campaign among colleges, municipalities, and religious organizations to divest their endowment or pension fund holdings from fossil fuel stocks. The divestment campaign, which is gathering momentum, was inspired by the international anti-apartheid divestment campaign of the 1980s that was an important part of the movement that helped topple South Africa's racist government. The first national organization to move forward with divestment was the United Church of Christ, which in June 2013 voted at its biennial General Synod to divest their fossil fuel holdings. The resolution was introduced by the Massachusetts Conference of the United Church of Christ, which is led by Dr. Reverend Jim Antell, its minister and president. 72% of the Synod's 800 delegates, representing some 5,000 congregations across the U.S., voted in favor of the resolution. Reverend Antell, who has become a national leader on climate change and divestment, has been arrested a number of times protesting fossil fuel projects, such as the proposed Keystone XL pipeline. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Reverend Antell about the United Church of Christ decision and what it means in practice, as well as the bigger picture of how fossil fuels trigger climate change.
In late July 2012, Bill McKibben wrote his now very famous article in Rolling Stone to initiate a divestment from fossil fuel companies movement. So within a year, we were able to muster enough education so that our 800-plus delegates gathered for our national gathering for the United Church of Christ that we do every 2 years, that they felt both compelled by conscience and informed enough to say, yes, divestment is, under these conditions, an appropriate move. As Desmond Tutu told us, it's very rare to use the tactic of divestment. But under these conditions, when you have a set of companies which, if all they do is carry out their business plan, they will wreck the earth. Under those conditions, shareholder activism doesn't work. What works is communicating unambiguously to those companies that they are part of a structural evil in the country, in the world, I should say, and that as people of conscience, as people of faith, we want to do everything we can to revoke the social license that society has granted them up until this point and say, from here on out, no more.
Jim Antle, describe exactly what the resolution does.
We have in our denomination two financial entities. One is United Church Funds, and that's an investment agency which holds the endowments of many of our congregations and other parts of our denomination and invests them in socially responsible ways. One of the things they signed on to was that within 18 months, they currently have 11 funds, they would create a 12th fund that would be fossil fuel free. And they are well on their way to doing that. And what that would mean is that any congregation or other entities of our denomination who were investing their holdings, their endowments, with United Church Funds, they would be able to say, we want our investments to be held in the fossil fuel-free fund. We also have a pension board, and the pension boards hold the pension contributions from about 20,000 United Church of Christ ministers and employees. And they are somewhat supportive of this resolution, but they have made no promise as to whether or not they will allow people who have accumulated pension monies to designate a fossil fuel free fund as the fund in which their pensions would go. What they have done is to ramp up their shareholder activism on climate. And so both of these financial entities of our denomination are paying much, much more attention. They're prioritizing their attention to climate issues.
I'm a little confused about the 11 funds and the new 12th fossil fuel fund. Creating a new fund isn't the same as divesting fossil fuel stocks from the existing funds, right?
We're basically a bottom-up denomination, not a top-down denomination. So the fact that our national body took this vote does not obligate any entity in the United Church of Christ to do anything. What it does is bear witness to our 5,000 congregations and other entities in the United Church of Christ that the discernment of our national body representing all aspects of our church is that divestment is a path we should follow. And as a consequence, right now there are scores and scores and scores of congregations who are having exactly that conversation.
I know the divestment campaign initiated by 350.org is a moral as opposed to an economic campaign, but do you think if it gets big enough, it could have an economic impact as well?
Ultimately, the world has to bring together its kind of moral axis with the kind of weight of the 150 years of history in which what we refer to as, you know, our current civilization, depending on fossil fuels.
Due to fracking for oil, the U.S. is on track to be one of the biggest oil producers in the world in a few years. And natural gas is booming also due to fracking. This seems like a juggernaut with no way of stopping if profit is still the moving force behind it.
So it falls to the movement to say to that momentum, we have to stop. If we can get our politicians to stop it, that's fine. If we can get divestment to stop it, that's fine. If it takes placing our bodies over the railroad tracks that are transporting oil all over the place, we'll do that. There's a variety of tactics that are to be employed, but they must all be employed if we expect to have our children and our grandchildren live on a planet that's recognizable.
That was Reverend Dr. Jim Antell, minister and president of the Massachusetts Conference of the United Church of Christ. Find more information on the fossil fuels divestment movement by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Immediately after the Supreme Court's controversial June 25, 5-4 ruling invalidating Section 4, a key element of the 1965 Voting Rights Act, states across the country that had previously been prevented from implementing restrictive voter ID laws, reduced early voting schedules, and limiting voter registration moved quickly to revive those once outlawed measures. States moving to impose new restrictive voting laws, widely seen as a mechanism to disenfranchise minority, student, and elderly voters, included Texas, North Carolina, Alabama, and Mississippi, all dominated by the Republican Party. While President Obama's Attorney General Eric Holder attempted to use the remaining provisions of the Voting Rights Act to challenge some of these discriminatory laws, civil rights activists demanded that Congress work toward a more permanent solution, by quickly replacing Section 4 of the Voting Rights Act, struck down by the Supreme Court. Now new legislation, introduced by Democrat Senator Patrick Leahy and Representative John Conyers and Republican Representative Jim Sensenbrenner, would amend the formula in Section 4 of the Voting Rights Act. The bill would require states to undergo preclearance if five or more voting rights violations have occurred within the last 15 years in the state or a locality within the state. Reviews of the proposed repair are mixed, with critics noting that the number of states required to undergo federal oversight would be substantially reduced, and violations involving discriminatory voter ID requirements would not count against a jurisdiction. Your reporter spoke with Marge Baker, executive vice president with People for the American Way, who discusses her group's view of the recently proposed congressional legislation to strengthen the 1965 Voting Rights Act, eroded in the June 2013 Supreme Court decision.
There's five key provisions to the bill. One is that it enhances the power of the federal courts to stop discriminatory voting changes from being implemented. So it provides some power for the courts to issue so-called injunctions. And also to order a preclearance remedy if a preclearance remedy turns out to be needed because the jurisdiction is behaving poorly. It also provides a new flexible coverage formula updated annually to require preclearance for all the changes in voting rights regulations in certain covered jurisdictions. It also creates new transparency requirements that help communities and voters know about key changes in their voting laws. And it continues and enhances the federal observer program. All of these are really critical provisions, and it's also important that they're modern, they're flexible, they're forward-looking set of protections, which will restore a huge part of the power of the Voting Rights Act that the court's decision in Shelby County undid.
So overall, you think this is a step forward, but what further repairs you think need to be made, especially on these voter ID laws, which seem to be really the focus of attention of a lot of these state governments controlled by Republicans who seemingly want to exclude certain people from voting?
Right. So what the bill does with respect to most voting laws, except voter ID, the law can be invalidated if it's shown to have a discriminatory impact, a discriminatory result. In the past, what had to be shown was that the law was intended to discriminate, and that's hard to prove. So in many respects, for all laws but voter ID laws, it's discriminatory result that the courts and the Justice Department will look at. With respect to voter ID laws where there is a discriminatory intent are still not permissible. But voter ID laws where you can't prove intent but can show that they have a discriminatory result are accepted. And we believe that as we're going through this process, that voter ID laws really shouldn't be treated any differently than other laws. And we'll work to try to fix that. Although I do want to make it clear that where there is an ability to prove that the voter ID law was intentional, and in fact, there's in some cases there have been records of comments by public officials who are enacting these laws to that effect, that's not acceptable. But we do have to deal with that sort of carve-out of some of the voter ID laws where there's a discriminatory impact but not intent.
Marge, I wondered if you'd comment on the motivation that the Republican Party, which has been behind much of these changes in voting law, which has the effect of disenfranchising certain groups which generally vote for the Democratic Party. It seems that with the demographic shift in the United States and the inherent advantages for the Democrats and disadvantages for Republicans, that the GOP has been increasingly resorting to dirty tricks and undemocratic and unethical schemes, which unfortunately don't seem to be called out for the blatant attacks on democracy they are by our media, or even, you know, so much by the Justice Department and local state attorney generals.
Right. I think it's extremely important to keep our eye focused on this. I mean, it's really interesting. A lot of the sort of voter suppression efforts are part of an agenda being advanced by the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, and I'm sure a lot of your listeners have heard about. Paul Weyrich, who's one of the founders of ALEC, is notably quoted on record that they don't want everybody. He doesn't want everybody to vote. That's not what he envisions, because if everybody votes, he can't get folks elected to advance the policies that he's interested in advancing. So, I mean, I think we absolutely have to keep a focus on this. We have to make sure that we are doing everything possible to call it out and call people on it. And again, I think some of the reforms, especially where these voter suppression efforts are aimed at discrimination, will be addressed in this reform Voting Rights Act that's working its way through Congress. I think it's really important to press for that. And the other thing is that our experience here has been that, to a certain extent, the voter suppression itself has been a call to action, and it's made people even more determined to vote. So that, you know, in Florida, you had people standing in line to vote even after the polls were closed because they wanted to make sure. They just wanted to make sure that vote was cast. So to a certain extent, I think it's important to call attention to it. I think it's important to try to enact whatever reforms we can. And it's also important to not let voters not let themselves be stopped by efforts to suppress the vote. It's too important, too precious a right.
That was Marge Baker, Executive Vice President with People for the American Way. For more news and commentary on restoration of the Voting Rights Act and discriminatory voter suppression tactics, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.